I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I thank you for joining us this week. With me in the studio today, it's the very excellent Alison Rudd, who is presently applying chapstick. Down the line, we have, from an undisclosed location, somewhere in far west London, probably not very far from Matthew Syed's house, it's Matt Dickinson, who I believe is also applying chapstick.
I'm very close to Matthew Syed's mansion rather than house. I think you've got to get the right terminology there.
I think gaffe is the term we like to use. It's the book a lot of people are talking about, Brave New World, Inside Mauricio Pochettino's Tottenham Hotspur. I am delighted that joining us for that is going to be an alumnus of the Game podcast and a good friend of mine, Guillaume Balaguer, who of course went and actually physically wrote the book. Not that Pochettino wouldn't have been able to, it's just that he's very busy, unlike Guillaume, who's just a layabout and does very little. But first, of course, we need to start at Stamford Bridge. I'm delighted that we're joined for this part of the discussion by Henry Winter as well. Henry, the backdrop to this, a bad defeat in Rome, the usual murmurs about people being unhappy, sniping from Mourinho, Conte happily sniping back. And then he decides, I think, that if he's going to go down, he's going to go down on his terms. And he makes a big statement by dropping David Luiz, not even on the bench, going out afterwards and saying, well, I don't know if he has a future here. Did that surprise you?
Not if you've seen Christensen play this season, and you know that David Luiz can, despite his sort of goal threat, despite the sort of flamboyance and the sort of Brazilian element to him, you know, he takes risks. And I wouldn't have necessarily thought he was a Conte type of defender in the first place, particularly when you look at over the summer the type of defenders that Conte was linked with, and particularly if you've talked to Michael Emanalo about Christensen's development. I mean, they've got this, you know Cobham well, and they've got this road that goes down the middle, and they've got this sort of academy on one side, and they're developing all these sort of young prospects there, and they go out on loan as Christensen did, became player of the year over at Borussia Mönchengladbach, and he was fantastic over there and developed. And all the while, Emanalo and the other coaches down at Cobham, outside of the first team, were keeping tabs on his process. They were Skyping him. They got a room downstairs in which they go through all his games. They talk to him about his strengths, his weaknesses, how he's developing on and off the pitch. He sounds like a sensible individual, anyone, 21-year-old Danes often are, very well educated, intelligent. So it wasn't a complete surprise. I think it's terrific. Okay, I was slightly surprised on that Gary Cahill hasn't come under more pressure.
But sorry, Henry, but it's one thing to start Christensen ahead of David Luiz. But he didn't just drop Luiz from starting 11. He dropped him from the squad entirely. Yeah. And he kind of made it very clear that this was some kind of discipline stroke punishment. And I think that's a big statement, no?
Okay. I mean, let's look at this. I mean, in classic English media terms, this is a fire and ice situation. The ice is that, was it the right tactical decision to make? Christensen deserved his start. David Luiz had made one or two mistakes. The fire element, of course, is what the media brings and also what Conte's personality brings to any scenario, inflaming it slightly, is that some of his comments and David Luiz's profile as well, that any comments, and he did slightly backtrack in his press conference compared to what he said on television. Well, I thought they were slightly provocative, slightly unnecessary, but actually, if he wants to send out a message, a big statement, as some people put it in caps up letters, then he's doing it from a position of strength with Christensen. doing well. And it wasn't simply about Christensen. Obviously, Kante returned. There's been so much hysteria about Chelsea ignoring the fact they were missing the Footballer of the Year, just like Manchester United are desperately missing Pogba. We saw that yesterday. Kante coming in. But the other thing that Conte did yesterday, which a lot of people quite rightly pointed out, the three-man midfield was terrific. Bakayoko was able to push on. Fabregas was man of the match, and there were other contenders there. Hazard playing just slightly off Morata. So it worked. So he got his tactics right. And we praised him for that after, you know, when he was 3-0 down, and 3-0 seems a bit of a theme against Arsenal last season. I think he deserves the praise now. I like Conte. I don't like good coaches being hounded out of this country. I think we should appreciate him, taking into account some of his over-emotional statements and comments and reactions. And okay, you know, you kind of have to live with that a bit, because the broader picture is that he's an exceptional coach.
Dicko, it seemed to me that United really struggled, despite trying to perhaps attack and engage Chelsea more. Chelsea were pretty dominant, weren't they?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I thought, as Henry says, Kante returning gave sort of reassurance and allowed Fabregas to absolutely blossom some fantastic passing, and Bakayoko finishing needs sharpening up, but his running was key from midfield, not least for the goal, stretching United's defence. And I asked Mourinho yesterday about, you know, this sort of pretty glaring stat. Lukaku didn't even touch the ball in Chelsea's penalty area, which he sort of dismissed. Said, oh, you know, I was happy with his work and did plenty of work. But, I mean, it's a one-off. It's not just a one-off stat. The fact is United on the roads are stumbling. Yesterday, basically the only time they really threatened with any, you know, sustained pressure was sticking Fellaini on and shoving balls into the box. And that is not clearly a sort of long-term answer to attacking fluency. Pogba is hugely, hugely missed. Mourinho talked about him returning sooner rather than later. They certainly need him back for December the 9th, which could be the earliest title decider in history at this rate.
I would like to, I'm not quite sure why I'm doing this, but I would quite like to defend Mourinho a little in that... He did allow it to be an entertaining game, and, you know, it could have been a park bus lack of any effort at all. And when Fellaini did come on, if he's telling the truth about Fellaini not being fit to start, Chelsea did panic and they did retreat. They defended very deep and they allowed United about 10 minutes of looking like they could very well get an equaliser. It wasn't a disastrous performance from United, given the people they were missing and that Mkhitaryan was rubbish.
Henry, I take the point. I mean, I think I'm with Alisson a little bit. Mourinho tried, but he's obviously missing key players. I know Mkhitaryan got absolutely slaughtered by everybody. To be fair to him, earlier this season when he was playing with guys who could play, like Mata and Pogba, he was more productive. Now that maybe he has to carry more of the burden on his own, he's less productive.
I mean, it was strange last season. Manchester United fans were sort of calling for him to start and be used more regularly. Mourinho ignored that, and now he's almost overplaying him, partly because Pogba's not there. But that was, I mean, Matt's piece this morning was completely right. I mean, if you look at how Lukaku and Rashford were trying to play, there was just a void between them and midfield. But Mkhitaryan was supposed to sort of seize that opportunity, so Hazard style. And he simply didn't do it. So I don't think you can blame Mourinho's starting tactics. What I did find extraordinary was 5 minutes before half-time, they started kicking Hazard. Started before half-time, Valencia took him out, and then, obviously, first 10 minutes of the second half, Jones, then Herrera had a nibble. And it was almost like they thought, oh, we remember what our tactics were here sort of last season. It's coming up to half-time. Maybe Mourinho's going to do this. But I actually thought Mourinho, as soon as Alisson said, defending him, I thought his starting tactics, I don't think you could dispute too much, given that the options he had available.
Let's go back to the two managers, and I know it's a little bit lurid and a little bit sensationalist, but when a guy doesn't go and shake the other guy's hand at the final whistle, given that it is part of a ritual, I'm not going to say he's not entitled to do it, but when he does it, he's clearly sending a message, because you do it every other time. Dicko,
that he can't stand him, which, you know, I have to say I'm probably not going to go down the it's a nice ritual road. I mean, most managers do it because they think it's a politest thing to do, but Conte thinks, well, you know, I don't really want to do it because I don't seem to like the bloke very much, and with some valid reasons, I suspect. He decides at the final whistle, you know, he's got his own histrionics, but he decides to walk on the pitch, pump his fists and celebrate a huge result and not go and shake the hand of a bloke he doesn't like. And I don't think that's, yeah, I think it's funny, sort of being in the press room yesterday and the manager being asked about it, you know, Brexit, warm beer and our obsession with managers shaking hands are probably three things that confuse foreigners the most.
Yeah, Conte probably thought it would be a bit hypocritical because...
He did, that's exactly what he said.
After the 3-3 at Stamford Bridge with Roma, he was asked about Mourinho saying, oh, I don't bleat on about my injuries. Some managers just cry a lot when they've got injuries. And he didn't dismiss that. He was simmering when that was put to him, that Mourinho was having a go at his moaning. And he said he should look at himself, he shouldn't look at me. He was really cross. Matt's right. He doesn't like him. So if he'd rather celebrate with the fans and make time to seek out a man he has no respect for, then... it's fine, I suppose.
I take a slightly different tack. I think it would have been made the victory even greater if he'd gone over and in a sort of very patronising way shaken Mourinho's hand, taken the moral high ground, and then he could have said, listen, even though you lot say I don't like him, it's important to shake the hands, particularly if someone who is suffering, who's lost, who's been humiliated on his return to his former club. He wouldn't necessarily have had to come out sort of all sort of Verdi style, but it would have been quite sort of fun. I like that. I think because, unfortunately, it's slightly detracted from... everyone was talking about the handshake, rather than the fact that he'd made three very intelligent substitutions, which had countered what Mourinho was doing. Rudiger coming on, Drinkwater coming on, then Willian coming on. All those three substitutions. I was going, wow, this guy is really a class act, as if we needed reminding. I just like that idea of patronising someone you don't like by being over sort of charming.
Maybe you should go up and dab him, or, you know, sort of do a fake, or, you know, do a dummy run or something. But, no, I mean... he was actually, Gary Neville, I did an interview with him a week or so ago, and he said, we were just talking about the sort of way the season's shaping up, and he said that he felt there was a sort of volcano ready to explode in terms of the big man. You got all these big egos in the league, group of big beasts we haven't had for a while in terms of Conte, Klopp, Guardiola, Mourinho, obviously Pochettino's on the rise, etc. And he just said, yeah, he just felt it was simmering and ready to explode, because ultimately, you know, only one or two of them are going to win any trophies this year, and the way it's going, it's already looking like Guardiola's got his hands on at least one of them. So he thought it was ready to kick off, and he couldn't wait for it, to be honest. He said, fantastic, you know, the Premier League at its best has Fergie v Benitez, or Fergie v Wenger, or, you know, Fergie v Keegan, and great, you know, let's see these, you know, intense, incredibly intense rivalries between brilliant managers come bubbling up.
Matt, I'll tell you what, and Alison, we must get to the LMA end of season dinner early. Get our places at the bar, because it really will kick off there. It normally gets a little bit sort of tense or sort of jovial from about 10:30 onwards. So I think it could be fight night there.
Now this season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, and the FA Cup as well. Now, just £8 for an 8-week trial. And in addition to all those goals, you also get, and I like to underscore this because I like to think of myself as a newspaper guy, a tremendous amount of quality written content from all of us. I think it's a really good deal. I would say that, of course. But now, with that in mind, let's discuss our goal of the weekend. Dicko, what was your choice?
My choice was Van La Parra. I'm not normally a sort of guy who goes for the, you know, the big long range. I like a bit of deftness in my favourite goals. But this one, there weren't a lot of deft goals this weekend. A lot of corner set pieces. And B, Van La Parra, I mean, it's a heck of a shot, isn't it? It's a big win for Huddersfield. And when you stick one in from 30 yards with a little bit of dip, a bit of curl, then who isn't happy?
On that goal, incidentally, I saw Tony Pulis complaining about that it should have been a free kick the other way in the lead up to the goal. I'm like, oh, wow, you know, controversial. But it was a whole sequence before the goal.
Good 20 minutes earlier, yeah.
I'm all for, like, going and managers who complain and stuff, and you're entitled to do it. But but then it had no impact on the goal either, because it's a guy just swinging his leg from, you know, it's not like the free kick led to some clear-cut chance. It's just a lot of sideways passing.
And Tony then this guy, Pulis, is big on parallel universes, and he knows if that free kick had gone West Brom's way, it would have been a very different outcome.
It's been different outcomes? Your goal, I would imagine, it's tinged in red.
Yeah, it's self-indulgent choice. It's Salah's first against West Ham because, one, I was made to suffer sat at Wembley as Liverpool were humiliated by Spurs not so very long ago. So it was nice to see the flip side of that. And there's something about Mane being back, fit, and alongside Salah, and you kind of feel all things are possible when Liverpool have those two players available. It was a funny goal. The defending was really quite crass and silly. And Salah had to sort of slow down to make sure, because he's almost sort of too fast for his own good sometimes. And also, I think it marked the moment in my football watching life where I believe Salah will score. Whereas I think up until now, even though his scoring record is phenomenal, I always think, oh, he's not necessarily that reliable. He does all the difficult things and then misses. I sort of now think he's a proper, reliable striker.
All right, let's move on to the Etihad. And, all right, we're going to talk Man City and their brilliance in a second. But I want to start with our qualified ref, Alison Rudd. Arsene Wenger was unhappy. He thought David Silva was offside. He thought that Raheem Sterling took a dive. I think he said something like, well, of course, City are unbeatable if they keep getting these decisions. Does he have a case? Is it clever to come out with something like this?
No, of course not. You're not supposed to come out with stuff like that. You have to believe the officials do the best job they can, that they're not all City fans. I mean, it's a ridiculous thing for him to say. It was one of those decisions which is bound to rile the manager against whom it goes, because it was one of those 51%, 49% penalties. I think some referees might have decided there was too little there. Some referees might have thought Sterling, you know, ran across, was hoping his leg would get tangled up. Some referees would have said it was shoulder to shoulder, and you will get tangling of legs right as a consequence.
I thought it was at least 80-20. I mean, you know, there is the shoulder and the tangle of legs, which is, you know, caused by Monreal, who's basically been done. I mean, you just look at, you know, it's one of those things you just look at and just say, well, defender knows he's in trouble and he's trying to get across the player. And I mean, when Wenger's at his most peevish, I mean, obviously he was furious about the offside, which was a really poor call, but when Wenger gets peevish, he gets really peevish. And I see there was, you know, other comments about officials are getting worse each season based on absolutely nothing apart from just being in a bad mood, and saying referees do not work hard enough.
I want to ask about Arsenal, because just actually the way they played. He's obviously wedded to this three at the back system because it yields some good results. Alison, to me, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever, because you play three at the back if your players know how to do it well. And they did get some decent results with it, but you need to have the personnel to do it. If you're shoehorning Francis Coughlin as a centre back, it's not going to work.
Yeah, no. Well,
and they look better in the second half when they change the system back
to back. Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. I think probably I am a conservative when it comes to analysing football, and I would suggest that if you do operate three at the back, particularly somewhere against a top six team, you need to know the personnel in those positions are expert at it, that they've practiced it, that they're very well drilled in it, and it was thrown together as an emergency formation. So why you think you can go to the Etihad with a group of players that haven't played three at the back together before? I don't think those three have played together in that system before.
Surely not Coughlin at centre-back.
Exactly. So it just seems to me you're better off reverting to a system where more players have played it more of the time and they're more used to it. Yeah, I agree with you completely. It seemed slightly self-indulgent even. But worse was not playing with an out-and-out centre-forward. I mean, the only weaknesses in City are they don't have as many tall players as you. So, you know, just try and threaten them in some way. Make them have to think about something. But that to me was more annoying than playing a cobbled together three at the back was starting with Sanchez and not Lacazette.
It looked as if they wanted to play the little people and try to somehow press them.
We're not going to do that. No, look at the table. Look at the table. You're not going to do that. They're the better team at the moment.
Well,
why do you think you can match them man for man?
To be fair, though, I mean, Napoli and Shakhtar Donetsk both pressed City high and created a lot of problems for them.
But not enough. Napoli are in better form than Arsenal, aren't they?
Yeah,
outside of the Champions League,
probably are, but yeah, it's still odd when you leave Lacazette on the bench, right? It's just weird.
Yeah, no, I can't.
And it's just as odd that you keep Giroud, who's like the backup to the backup of the backup, right?
It's not the only time he's left Lacazette on the bench, and then it's odd. I mean, there's no explanation apart from I can't even think of one actually. He's and Alisson's right. I mean, it didn't make sense. The sort of throw together a defence. I know you've got issues, but that didn't work. And I think we saw highlighted how inefficient the pressing was. You know, one guy goes and the rest are going, what are you doing that for? And then he turns around and Sanchez seemed to be throwing his arms in the air as much as he was doing anything. And it's back to the same old issues with Arsenal about just what drilling is there going on the training ground to make them efficient. You know, we know they've got quality players, but they're not a team that week to week, are being drilled to have a plan for a specific game.
I thought our colleague, I'm trying to think of new and original things to say about City, and I thought our colleague Ollie Kay wrote a fine column on Saturday where he made the point that, yes, Guardiola spent an absolute ton of money and they have an enormous wage bill, but incidentally, it's not that enormous relative to Chelsea and Manchester United and other big clubs. But the fact that he objectively made players better with guys like Raheem Sterling, like John Stones, like Otamendi, Kyle Walker from what we've seen this year. I wonder, how much stock do you put on that? I mean, are these guys who would have been just as good if they'd remained with a different manager, if he'd never shown up? Or has he actually worked with them and made them better players? Or does the system just make them seem like better players?
I think if the players think Guardiola is a god, they will improve. You have to buy into the myth. Maybe myth's the wrong word. That implies that I don't think he's a very good manager. He's obviously okay. But if the players believe in him... Okay, so you've got several things going on. One is Pep Guardiola's CV and the fact that he is such a strong philosophy, such a strong personality and knows what he wants to do. If the players buy into that, they will necessarily improve because they will do what he says to do to get better. There'll be no, I can't do that. I wasn't taught that when I was six. So I think that happens. If you're surrounded by excellent players, there's no weak links in that team apart from maybe Otamendi. Well, Delph's played really well, hasn't he? He's just been very solid. He's not been bad.
Isn't that kind of like the epitome? Here's a guy who's a central midfielder who's been injured for yonks, and yet.
And you've got to give him credit for taking his chance. He's taken his chance.
He's playing a different position. That's obviously a credit to Delph, who follows Guardiola's instructions. But it's also the credit to Guardiola, who looks at the guy and says, I can teach you to play left back at a very high level. You who've never done it, who doesn't have the acceleration of a left back, who doesn't really have the skill set of a left back.
Absolutely, which brings me back to the point that Delph can only do that if he believes in Guardiola. So if you believe in the cult of Guardiola and he tells you can play left back, you will believe it.
But also I think it's about specifics, isn't it? I think basically players can do that, and basically that back to that comparison really with Arsenal, if the manager is very specific about what he wants from you, what he needs from you. And we saw it with Conte's Chelsea last year. You can see the value of good coaching when you saw that Victor Moses became a title winning wing back because he was a coach who absolutely drilled him, told him very specifically where you move, how you move, when, you know, how are we going to play out the back, where, you know, if the ball's being built up on the left, this is where you go on the right. To absolute detail, and that's Guardiola's style. I mean, I'm told certain players find him irritating as hell because he is on their case all the time. You know, he's incredibly demanding. He's not an easy guy a lot of the time to work around, but it's very clear what he wants from you. If I'm playing Fabian Delph here, this is what I need you to do. This is where you move. If I'm playing you another place, this is what you do. And, you know, it's I'm simplifying a very... obviously a more complicated job, but you can see the teams that have coaches who are painstaking.
Theoretically, it's what every manager should be doing. It's just that some guys are better at it than others, evidently.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr and Mrs.
Oh, no,
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Just got news. Slaven Bilic is no longer the West Ham United manager. There obviously are strong rumors about David Moyes that may or may not happen. We'll deal with it later. I want to look back, though, on Bilic. Think of what went wrong.
West Ham, there's normally quite a few things that go wrong. I think that on a short term, to be honest, defensive organisation, again, we're back to that issue of, you know, managers do a lot of things. They look for players. They make 100 decisions every day about, you know, organisation of the club. But their critical job is being on top of the 11 players who go out and making sure everyone knows exactly what their role is. And I bumped into someone at West Ham recently who just said that they thought Slaven was a really good motivator of people and a pretty decent coach, but that they sort of got sloppy, certainly in defensive organisation, and I think there were signs of that. I think his own motivation had ebbed because he knew he was in the last year of a contract. He knew he was dead man walking. I think that comes then back to the issue of a club that is pretty dysfunctional at the top. You've got David Sullivan, who is a sort of a de facto director of football, well, and his son, who like to be very involved in transfer policy. You've got Karen Brady, who brings her own unique style of management to the party. Then you've got David Gold, and the three of them are often pulling different ways on the same issues. So it really is not an easy club to be manager of, and I think Bilic have got worn down by that.
But Alison, Slaven Bilic, I've just been reliably informed by our producer Charlie, who would not be making this up, he has the highest points per game ratio of any West Ham manager in the Premier League era, and he's gone. Might that not suggest that if they see problems there, maybe the problem isn't Bilic, maybe the problem is elsewhere?
Yeah, no, well, we forget how memories fade, don't they? I mean, West Ham were on course to get a Champions League place not so very long ago under Bilic. He's popular with the fans. He fell this season because he'd built, maybe you'd say stupidly, a manager should not do this, but he'd envisaged the team working around William Carvalho from Sporting Lisbon, and that deal failed. Mark Noble is getting on a bit. It's looking a bit fragile in the middle. He needs that. You look at West Ham, and that is exactly what they need. They can sort of splinter and go all over the place. There's no one holding it together. And more importantly, I think the fact that that deal fell through. Gold and Sullivan were called the Dildo Brothers, and Bilic made a joke about that. I think we're not a family anymore. There's no respect here, and they were looking for a reason to get rid of him after that. Because
have you seen David Sullivan?
Bilic, what do you mean? Have I seen David Sullivan?
Just everything about him. I mean, the stupid hat he wears, his little mini helicopter. I mean, what?
Well, I'm not going to judge a person on their on what they look like. That would be
what about his life's work?
It's how,
would
it's
you do
how,
it based
it's
on that?
How, it's how
well I'm being arrested.
Well, The fact that, yeah, I mean, people like that, they yearn respect. That's why they buy the helicopters and the big houses and wear the silly hats. They're saying, look at me, I'm important. And if their manager goes along with a joke about their porn empire, that is belittling, and the relationship has gone, hasn't it? So, but any manager going to West Ham now has to battle the fact that the fans are disenchanted and the stadium is a very difficult place to be a supporter at. Just walking to the stadium, the fans find difficult because it's so soulless. You need extra entertainment, extra points on the board. You need something special there to make it all click together. And yeah, Bilic was treading in mud by the end.
From one set of club owners to another. I'm going to be careful now what I say for legal reasons, but the big story breaking with the Panama Papers, as they come to be known, there was an offshore law firm, I guess, in Panama, which helped set up these offshore accounts where people could conceal some of their financial transactions if they so chose. Of course, they were obligated to report them. Anyway, it's part of this whole thing, and it is legal. It's not illegal. It's tax avoidance rather than tax evasion. It has emerged, or it's been suggested, according to BBC's Panorama, that maybe Farhad Mashiri didn't buy half of Everton with his own money, but that there's the cuddly Alisher Usmanov pulling the strings behind him. Of course, Mashiri had a shareholding in Arsenal, which Usmanov also does, although it's the crummy 30% shareholding where Kroenke won't allow them onto the board. Long and short of this is the implication is that Usmanov somehow exercises control over Everton, something he denies, although Usmanov's company, which I'm sure we've all heard of, and they've actually gone and sponsored, Finch Farm, which is Everton's training ground. Dicko, what do you make of this?
I make of it that it reinforces many regular calls for far more transparency about club ownership. There should be far more obligation, probably legal obligation, on clubs to be clear about who owns. I know they're private entities now. I know there's a free market, but the fact is that football clubs have quite a unique place in sort of cultural life, and fans, I think, understandably feel they have a right to know who owns their football club. And we had this, we've seen this time and again, not least at Leeds United, too many opaque ownership models. I think on a general point, it absolutely reinforces calls for that to be made clear.
Listen, since we're in the business of pure speculation, because we are the media, I'm trying to figure out why would Usmanov do this,
exactly,
if indeed he has done it?
If this was a detective story, you'd say, what is the motive?
Could the motive be this? I'm Usmanov. I have a ton of money tied up at Arsenal, but Kroenke won't sell to me at a price that I want to pay, and he won't even allow me to sit on the board. So I own 30%, but I've got nothing really other than a little dividend. But in the end, there's no dividend because Kroenke just piles up the cash inside the club. Why shouldn't I be allowed to exercise control over a football club, right? I'm stuck there with these shares, and the guy won't let me do anything with them. He won't let me near the boardroom. What's wrong with me going out and having a little escape hatch through another club up north where I get my mate to take over? So if worst comes to worst with Kroenke, I just sell him the shares or sell the shares to somebody else, get out, and I have a ready-made place to land. Why am I not allowed to do that, Alison?
Well, you can do it, but you can't do it at the same time. So you can do it by talking to him and making sure you say stay busy mates, but you can't lend him the money to do the influential things that you're then gonna come back one day and say, remember when I helped you out? Come on, give me Everton, make it mine, all mine.
All right, joining us now is a guy who used to co-host this podcast many years ago before the company decided to sack him because I'm a lot better than he is. It's Guillaume Balague, and you'll know him as Spanish football and Premier League football supremo, and he has a book out entitled Brave New World Inside Pochettino's Spurs. Guillaume, welcome. I need to start with this because I know the genesis of this because we talked about it at the time, but how do you get so much access from a Premier League manager? And not just, after the fact ghosting something, but so much access during an actual season, not knowing how things were going to work out. When you started the project, for all you knew, Pochettino might get sacked or kidnapped by aliens. Anything could have happened.
Yeah, and in fact, I remember you were the first person that talked about this, and the not only the projection of in 2 years down the road what was going to happen, but also how would the book be perceived, and would he buy the whole idea? I remember you being quite, what would be the word, negative about it?
Apprehensive.
Apprehensive. And rightly so, because unless you had that kind of access, this book didn't make no sense. So it helps that I've known him for a long time. I would say probably consider myself a friend of his. But of course, this was taking the friendship to another level. I was asking for total access for a whole year. The thing is, though, he's read the Messi book, and he's aware of the Pep Guardiola book as well, and knew that it was a project that had to go deep into his way of working and thinking.
Just to clarify, sorry, because just for listeners who might not get this, when you talk about the Messi book and the Guardiola book, you're obviously talking about Marti Perarnau's Guardiola book and Harry Harris's Lionel Messi book, right?
Has he done one?
No, I would imagine he would have. No, I'm kidding. But he's talking about two projects that you worked on before, the Pep Guardiola book and the Lionel Messi book, right?
Yeah, with Pep, he was on his last year at Barcelona, and again, he opened doors. He understood what he was all about, and the Messi one is the only authorized biography on Messi that I work with his family and himself. So he was aware of all that, of the levels of the demand that a project like this takes. But at first he was like, well, I'm not sure. I mean, what would be the point? But then Karina, his wife, said, you have to do it. She saw even earlier than him that it was a way of explaining him, a way of trying to understand what he's about, how he works, what makes him different. In certain parts, he's very different to others. And I had to see it. And then we had to convert that into a book. The next thing is that what kind of style or what kind of genre I was going to choose. And that's what took him a little bit by surprise. And I think he didn't really understand what I meant until he got the draft later on. I said, well, have a look, because these are your words. So after having spoken to everybody around him and having been there every Monday and seen how he works and talking to his family and traveled to see other people that he's been with, I decided to make it a diary of the season. And also a biography in the first person, which is like I, Claudius, for some of you that may have read that, or Memoirs of Hadrian, two of my favorite books, are written by authors about somebody else. They are biographies, but they are done in the first person. So he was like, yeah, whatever. And then when he saw the draft and it was in Spanish, I said, well, have a look, because my worry is that it has to sound like you. I know that the things that are here, you've said, or people near you have said, or a few players have said, but that you have to agree with it. So he read it. His only worry was how the tone in English was gonna be. But I said, look, your English is not good enough to have any tone whatsoever. So we're just going to make the best English we can. One thing that Gad knows, you talk to him, he's that funny. The way he uses the words is so interesting, and he's such a great raconteur. He tells you stories one after the other, and I've heard the same stories now sometimes three or four times, and uses the same words and tonations and jokes and punchlines. But he's so funny when he tells them. You wouldn't get that from his English.
Yeah, I can confirm that. I had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time with him last summer at Disney World in Florida, of all places. And
it was very hot, apparently, and you kept talking. That's what I heard.
That's what happens in a conversation. One of the defining themes for me of the last couple of years, because I don't understand what makes Harry Kane great. I can see that he's great. And he just seems so beyond the sum of the parts. And one thing that I've thrown to a lot of managers and a lot of football people is I try to get them to explain Harry Kane to me and why it took so long for, four different Spurs managers, even Pochettino at the beginning, to either not see it or to bring him along slowly. There's always stuff when we write books that we don't put in the book or with other insights. I know you discuss Kane in the book, but what's Poch's take about Harry Kane? Is he just like some kind of inexplicable freak, or can he just can he break him down to his constituent parts?
If I refresh myself, my memory, because I chose all the Kane parts in the book to put it all together for a double spread in Us, in the Spanish newspaper Werfo, and it reminded me that Pochettino saw straight away what Kane was made of. I'll tell you a couple of stories about Kane, which will tell you what Kane carries with him. But of course, as you said, he needed somebody to identify it and work on it. One is, when he went to Millwall, he actually went to see a game, and he sat with his family in the most, let's call it, noisy part of the stands of Millwall. And what happened there was that, you know, there was a lot of shouting, and there was a lot of pressure. He must have been 17, 18, I can't remember the age, but at the end of the game, parents were like, you're not coming here. And he said, oh yeah, I am coming here, because I want all this around me, all this pressure to push me, to keep me going. So that's what he's made of. And now he has got a house like an hour and a half from the training ground, but he's either rented or bought another one next to the training ground. So he's the first one arriving and the last one leaving, because he knows that work is what takes him where he is. When Pochettino arrived, Kane thought, this guy is going to bring an Argentinian striker, or, you know, there's a De Bayor and Soldado. He will want a top guy. I'm not going to do very well here. But what Pochettino saw was a guy, like many others in that team at the time, who had habits of a 30-year-old. He was an old man. He was overweight. He just behaved a little bit like somebody who's been there, done it all, when he was only 21, if I'm not mistaken. So he had to change that, but he did that by a confidence.
Just to be clear, you're talking about Harry Kane here, a 21, having the habits of a 30-year-old veteran.
Yes.
So in other words, yes, you mentioned Harry Kane at 21 being overweight, being a little lazy. This is what you're talking about, yeah?
Yeah.
Because it kind of smashes my image of Harry Kane. But
well, at the time, that was the culture of the club. There was a player, which I won't tell you who it is, who did not train on Mondays. Why? Well, because he doesn't train on Mondays. Oh, right, okay. So that's what they heard, Jesus and Mauricio, and they just were like, right, what's this? So this is the kind of club that he found, and there's another story I'd explain in the book, in which at the end of the Carling Cup final, Chelsea Spurs, in his first season at Spurs, there was a player of Spurs who went to the face of Jesus Perez at the end of the game and started chanting the Jose Mourinho song to Jesus Perez's face. This is one of his own players. So yeah, that's what they had to work against, and Harry Kane was part of all that in a way, as in, you know, he was doing what everybody else was doing. So quite clearly, very early on, he was told, keep working, this is what you have to do. He changed the way he worked as well. He focused his energies into what we see him doing now. He wasn't just a striker with his back to goal. He had to give much more. And then he was given opportunities. And it's given now as an example to the kids. Look what we've done with Harry Kane. We started playing him. He wasn't scoring. We kept playing him. Eventually, he killed Adebayor and he killed Soldado and became what he was. And they both love each other. They're very much into the regime that they and the atmosphere they created at the club.
Guillaume, I'm going to leave you with this question, which I know is going to make Spurs fans a little bit uncomfortable. But you were around the club. You had tremendous access to the club. You mentioned Real Madrid earlier in this interview. Inevitably, managers move on, and I'm assuming Pochettino has ambitions that, you know, he doesn't see himself turning into the Sir Alex Ferguson of Tottenham Hotspur.
Why?
Or I'm asking, maybe he does. But were he to move on, do you think he's left in place enough? Did you get a sense from the club that he's put in place enough practices, enough ways of working that the club can operate with somebody else in charge? Or do you think it's going to be starting from scratch if and when he moves on?
His impact on the club is so huge that it wouldn't be a like by like. You couldn't do that now. I mean, it's about putting a very modern structure where everybody gets the best out of everybody. But it's also the way he communicates with players, how he senses the energies of players, how he gives them hugs and kisses in the cheeks and that kind of thing that destroys barriers or pulls up new ones, depending who it is, of course. But it won't be as simple as that. And that's why in the conversation I had with Danny Levy, it was a very long one, and I used in the epilogue most of it. He mentions that he wants him to be his Sir Alex Ferguson and be at the club for 15 years. And he's joked already about it, Mauricio, saying, all right, well, where's the 15-year contract then? And the thing that this is very important for Spurs fans to understand is that number one, the club has too much his ambition. Now he is the driving force of that club now. But hand in hand with Danny Levy in a way that Daniel has not had that kind of thinking about coaches in the past. So they're hand in hand, but they're the driving forces. That's number one. But number two, at the beginning of their stay at Spurs, the coaching staff and Mauricio as well, they used to have this joke when they had a bad game, when Spurs had a bad game or they drew or they lost, somebody would put a towel in somebody's head and shout, "Why did we leave Southampton?" Because for them, it's not just steps towards a bigger career that ends up at Real Madrid. It's about, as Eddie Jones told me 3-4 weeks ago, it's about everybody wants to be part of something special. And they feel they are part of something special, of the creation of an identity, not just of a club that goes into a new stadium. There's an identity being created here, which I think Daniel Levy, in a way, has found, not by accident, but he probably didn't know exactly what was coming when Pochettino was coming. And when you have that, why leave it behind for as long as you can push on to win titles and to challenge for things? And those things are absolutely key. So forget about when Real Madrid comes calling, because already, as you should know, two of the top 10 clubs in Europe have already come calling. And the answer was no. So it's about continuing being part of this special thing.
The book is Brave New World, Inside Pochettino's Spurs. The author is Guillaume Balaguer. I'm really psyched to finish reading it. I think you should all check it out. And if you hit Guillaume up on Twitter, the first 1,000 people who write to him and write a little haiku, I'm told, will get free signed copies. That's correct, right, Guillaume?
Okay.
Guillaume, thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Now it's time for your favorite part of the show, and my favorite too. It's Quick Hits.
Graeme Souness liked it too.
Did he?
Did Quick Hits with Graeme Souness in your absence, girl.
No, you
did. I did. Didn't I, producer? Yeah, I did.
But did you have the sound effects that I have?
No, you know I think they're very rude. I don't use those.
Liverpool torment West Ham and win 4-1 away. Alison, given the successful pacey counterattacking of Mane and Salah, which ultimately cost Slaven Bilic's job, do you ever wonder if maybe it might be nice if Klopp in certain games, just to surprise everybody, ended up just parking the bus, having Coutinho sit in front of the back four, just pinging balls to the two roadrunners? Yeah. Might that work?
That would be hilarious, but it's not going to happen. He was speaking after the game about how he's assimilated Oxlade-Chamberlain into his high pressing, and he said things like, "We are all about the high press. We are all about intensity. There is no other way for Klopp, and he only brings in players that will do that and learn how to do that." For him to suddenly say one week, "Okay, we're just going to sit back, take it easy, guys, just rely on the pace of our paciest," it's not going to happen. But I agree, it would be great fun and a huge shock to everybody if he did it just once.
It was supposed to be a cakewalk, but it was anything but. Dicko, why did Tottenham find it so tough at Wembley against Crystal Palace? Are you going to blame Guillaume Balaguer's book?
I think, we probably look at a couple of reasons, can't we? Crystal Palace, Roy Hodgson is getting them pretty well drilled, as that's what he does. They've got some decent defenders, and Roy is beginning to work his painstaking training ground ways. I think we've seen that. And I think Spurs, probably when you've had the highs of Real Madrid recently, maybe it's a game where the energy levels, motivation levels are not on full steam.
I love how Hodgson came out afterwards and was so straight up about how, like, you need a goal scorer, and we have two wingers, and that's it. 2-0 down at home, and then they win 3-2 against Watford, albeit with a little help from Tom Cleverley, who conjures a way to miss an injury time penalty. Alison, did Unzi convince you he's fit for the Everton job?
I don't know, because
nothing to do with him, is that what you're going to say?
Well, partly, but it's not reality. If you come in as an emergency measure, especially if you're already part of the setup at the club, you can do things you wouldn't do if you were an external appointment, like bringing through youngsters, hauling off Wayne Rooney, trying everything. It's sort of football by numbers. Let's try this, let's try that, and then exude a lot of passion, which he does on the touchline. It's a fake world. I'm not even sure it's a decent audition, to be honest. If that's how he's going to manage till the end of the season, then no, that isn't a great way of going about being a manager. But I don't really see what else he could do, given the circumstances.
We're all rooting for Anzi. West Brom fall at Huddersfield 1-0, but given Tony Pulis's recent record, Dicko, why does he feel the need to talk about how he has the faith of the Baggies board? Didn't they finish in the top half of the table last season?
Probably something to do with the fact that he's got a load of West Brom fans shouting Pulis out quite noisily at the whistle. They're getting a bit naffed off because the club's, the record in the last 6 months, going back into last season, ain't the best, and they're near the relegation zone. But a guy who's never been relegated in his career, I'd be surprised if they panic.
Glenn Murray scores again, and Brighton win at Swansea 1-0. Alison, please help me celebrate Glenn Murray, who I think is some kind of, I mean, we probably talked about this before, but I think he's some kind of everyman. He's Joe Blow, who just goes out there, or Joe Bloggs, you might say, who just goes out there and isn't particularly good at anything, but then scores goals, really big goals, 4 goals in 3 games, 7 of a possible 9 points for the Seagulls. The goals are flying with Glenn Murray.
Yeah, it's more about his reading of the game. And, you know, he's one of those strikers who's in the right place. I mean, he scored a header against West Ham where I think he was aiming for the other corner. It goes in off his thigh at the weekend. But he's there, and he's reading the game. And he is a bit of a throwback, and I'm very glad he exists. I mean, you know, he's gone through non-league, he went to America, I didn't think he was going to make it. Wherever he's been, people have said, wasn't he a bit old and rubbish? But he's just kept on going.
Stoke draw with Leicester City, and the big man does it again. Oh, we have a theme here with English centre forwards. Peter Crouch comes off the bench to score his 3rd goal of the season. Now, Dicko, he is 47 years old. Not really, but that's his metabolic age. And he's still productive. Is football ultimately, and this is a philosophical question, really that simple a game that if you have a guy who is 8 feet tall and has decent timing on a decent head on his shoulders, he'll keep scoring well into his 40s and there is nothing the opposition can do about it?
Yeah, I remember doing a column with Craig Bellamy at the last Euros, and he was saying, look, you know, just because you're a team that aspires to play a certain way, and maybe, you know, England talking about, you know, trying to get it down and use these young technical breaking and fast attackers, said that yes, exactly that. There comes a time when you need to drag fullbacks out of the way. So how do you do that? By making sure you've got wingers who are crossing to a big man, because it starts pulling all sorts of defenses all over the way, and as you say, gets centre halves worried. So yeah, let's not rule out that what is regarded as unsophisticated plan B. I'm not advocating Crouch for the England squad, by the way, but the notion of the big man shouldn't just be dismissed.
That's our Peter Crouch discussion for the season.
But you have to answer a question.
Ooh, do I?
Germany's version of the Classico, apparently, was held on Saturday. What happened when Bayern travelled to face Borussia Dortmund?
I suppose you haven't read my excellent column in the game then, Alison, if you're asking me that question. It's been absolutely remarkable. So 3 weeks ago, Borussia Dortmund were 5 points ahead of Bayern in the table. Today, after losing 3-1 at home, they're 6 points behind them. That's an 11-point swing in 3 weeks, which is sort of difficult to even imagine. It has to do with the fact that obviously Bayern won their games, but it's also, and I allude to this, Jupp Heynckes is extremely old to the point that he's achieved some kind of weirdo Jedi force. Seriously, he's 73 years old. He's far and away the oldest manager in the Champions League. He told people he'd retired in 2013, but actually what he's done is he's gone away and he has learned to go and master the force and thereby really attained Jedi level.
Does he put verbs in the wrong place?
Sometimes when he chooses to, yes. And what he did was, the minute he got appointed, he said, all right, well, we can win our games, but we need to slow the opposition down. So let me go with this Peter Boss guy, who's the Borussia Dortmund manager, who I think is terrible personally, and let's go and mess with his head and mess with his teams. And since then, Borussia Dortmund have drawn home and away with Apoel in the Champions League. They lost to Hanover. They lost at home to Leipzig. Their team's basically been rubbish. They could never defend well, but now they look worse than they did before. They've been put in those situations. And that's the genius of Heynckes. He doesn't just make Bayern better. He makes everybody else worse.
Hi there, and welcome to the Game Week 11 recap from The Sweeper, which is, of course, the Times' fantasy football tip service. This week, I'm up Sweeper Creek without a paddy, as Mr. Umbera is having a well-deserved week off in Cheltenham. So, this weekend, Mohamed Salah was our tip of the week from Friday's email. The Egyptian forward was in sensational form as Liverpool carved through West Ham on Saturday, scoring twice and picking up all three bonus points against the unhappy Hammers. He scored 15 points, which was the joint highest in the league. We also nudged you in the direction of Richarlison, and the Watford attacker produced the goods by scoring 7 points. The Brazilian scored in a 3-2 defeat by Everton and would have grabbed an assist too, but for Tom Cleverley's missed penalty in the dying stages. You could tell that Richarlison wanted to take it too, so that was a painful one for his owners. Elsewhere, Sean Dyche must be considering opening up a laundrette because of the number of clean sheets that Burnley are producing. It's quite phenomenal. Ben Mee and the gang secured their 5th shutout in the past 8 game weeks against Southampton. And I know we've spoken about this before, but it's worth repeating. 4 of Burnley's back 5 cost only £4.5 million, so please, if you're not on that already, then get involved. International fortnight now, so remember Paddy's sage advice from last time out. No matter how frustrated you might be with your team and if they're underperforming, unless you're playing a wild card, then hold fire before making transfers, as you never know what might happen in the next 2 weeks. On the flip side of that, plenty of big names like Paul Pogba, Adam Lallana, Danny Welbeck, Vincent Kompany and Dele Alli are scheduled to return to full fitness, so it's worth monitoring their progress before making any rash moves. For more nuggets of wisdom from Paddy and occasionally myself, sign up for The Sweeper at thetimes.co.uk/fantasyfootball to get an email each Friday packed full of fantasy football tips. This Friday's email will have the question for our October competition to win a 12-month digital subscription to The Times. The deadline for entries for that is midnight on Friday evening. We will have a full run-through of Game Week 11, including the curse of the high-profile transfer and an update on the Times Mini League, up on the website later today, so do keep an eye out for that.
Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my excellent guests, Alison Rudd, Matt Dickinson, Guillaume Balaguer, who came on to talk about his book. Now remember, just £8 for an 8-week trial. You'd be mad not to. Search the Times online. You get access to all our excellent content, including some stuff that only lives on the websites, like these daily game columns. Actually writing mine on Tuesday to come up with a topic. And this season also, you can access highlights of every single game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, and the FA Cup. International break is coming up, everybody's favorite time of the year. Actually, to those of us whose countries are in the playoffs, like me, it matters a lot. We're going to be back next Monday when, who knows, maybe Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland could be on their way to the World Cup. Alison, what chances an all-Irish derby in the quarterfinals of the World Cup?
It's a certainty. Put your money on it now.
Pretty freaking cool if it did happen. Till next time, bye-bye.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.